welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast for December 17th. It's brought to you by Shooters in Nagoya. I'm John Gibson, and with me is Jim Allen. What's happening, buddy?
Not too much, bud. I had a Sunday off and enjoyed the day. How about you?
I had a Sunday at the office, and it was okay. It wasn't so bad this time. But this is the last podcast of the year, man. Can you believe it?
And it's been a lot of podcasts, but it's been a really interesting year so far. So hopefully we'll finish with a bang.
Yeah, well, this is going to be a great show, I think.
Yep.
We've got a very special guest. We're going to discuss the signing of Shohei Ohtani to the Fighters, and we're going to talk about the WBC and some other topics. So let's start clearing these juiced up bases. All right, so I got to talk to Wayne Grassick the other day. We went outside. We were actually having a farewell party for a friend, and I pulled him aside and I said, you know, I've been wanting to interview you for the show for a while, and would you mind doing it? So we went outside in the cold and we spoke for a few minutes. It was freezing, and I have to apologize right away. The wind was blowing, and I'm sure those of you who are familiar with the show know that sometimes when it's windy, my tape recorder picks up everything and it drowns out the voice. So it's a little rough at the beginning, but it comes in fine. So.
All right.
Wayne's a very special friend for me, and he helped me when I was starting my paper in Nagoya in 1994. I just called him out of the blue, and he actually helped me kind of get started covering the Dragons because we were not an official newspaper, so we needed to get contacts there and get in touch with people. And Wayne has been living in Japan for more than 40 years. He's been covering baseball since 1976. He has done a lot. I think his baseball bulletin column that runs in the Japan Times has been running for, it's been in the paper, I think, since 1976.
Something like that, yes.
Very long time. And he has a million stories, and I hope we have him on again. We didn't have that much time, but we did get to talk to him for a short time, so let's take a listen. All right, this week our very special guest is Wayne Grassick. He's lived in Japan for how long again?
43 years. Longer than you.
Longer than I have, but and you covered baseball since when?
Since 1976.
1976, wow. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for being on, John. Geez, one of the reasons I asked you to do the show was to find out about how the game has changed through the years. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I can remember my first game that I went to in Japanese baseball. I remember the date, too. It was August 20th, 1970. Before you were born, maybe.
No, I was six.
Okay. At Heiwan Stadium, woke up, and I saw the Shintetsu Lions play the Kintetsu Buffaloes. Two teams which no longer exist, but I really liked it a lot, and I was surprised that some of the players that were playing in that game, the farm players, the Buffaloes actually didn't have any farm players, but the Lions had two players. One guy's name was Aaron Pointer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a center fielder, and the other guy was Carl Bowles, and I had thought that they long since retired, because I remember them playing in the major leagues. Aaron Pointer was with the Houston Colt 45s.
This is a long time ago, folks.
1963.
At that time, I wasn't born.
Okay. And Carl Bowles was with the San Francisco Giants. And here they were playing in Fukuoka, Japan. I was really surprised. Aaron Pointer, by the way, you might be interested to know, is a brother of the Pointer Sisters, the famous singing group. And also, I think the thing I remember most about that game was, you remember when you first got here, probably when a foul ball got hit in the stands, the fans couldn't keep the foul balls?
Right, the ushers would come along and retreat it.
The ushers would retreat. Okay, in Heiwan Stadium in 1970, when a ball got hit in the stands, and there weren't that many people in the stands. The Lions were a lousy team and last place, and their attendance was about 5,000 a game.
So the balls could injure a lot of empty chairs.
Well, a fan would get the ball, and the system they had to retrieve the balls was the ball boy, the same guy who would bring baseballs to the home plate umpire.
when he ran out. He would come out off his stool, off the bench, and go out about halfway between the dugout and the baseline, and wave up to the stands. And the fan who got the ball would throw the ball down to the field.
They had a good enough arm.
Yeah. Well, either they had a lousy arm and it hit the fans down below, didn't make the field, or they would overthrow and they would roll out by shortstop and they had to stop the game. And that was one thing I remember. And also, I remember paying, you won't believe this, but 350 yen for a grandstand seat.
That's a ticket for the whole game or just the first three innings?
No, the whole game. The whole game. Right off first base.
Wow.
And that a ticket like that, you know, in, say in Fukuoka Dome or Tokyo Dome would cost, 5,000 yen maybe.
Yeah, much more than that.
Yeah. So that's one memory I have of my first game in Japan.
Now, another thing that I wanted to talk about was the fact that it seemed like everyone, when I came here in 1990, was a Giants fan. And I asked around, I asked so many people, why are you guys Giants fans? I mean, you can't just like this team just because they're popular. And they said, well, you know, on TV, this is all we get. We only get Giants games on TV and national TV broadcasts and national radio broadcasts. Can you talk about how the coverage of baseball has changed over the years now?
Well, that's right. In those days, there was no satellite TV, no cable TV. We just had the regular terrestrial channels, and it was the Giants game that was on every night. And if you wanted to watch baseball, you had to watch the Giants and whoever else they were playing in the Central League. There was no interleague play, and that was it. There was just no alternative to watching baseball on TV. Obviously, that has changed quite a bit since the advent of satellite TV, I believe, in 1989 or so. And now we have the cable TV, satellite TV. You can watch all six games on a given night if you have the system. And that's a big change that's happened in Japanese baseball over
internet,
the years.
Yeah, internet and iPhones also you can watch on those gadgets too. So mm-hmm. Now, you know, there's all kinds of players, and you've been here, you've seen a lot of players. Who's one of the players you're more fond of you came in contact with through the years?
Well, there's been quite a few. Leo Gomez, who you probably remember with the Dragons.
He's my little brother. Yeah, we look really similar, so sometimes people would think that I was Leo. I'm a little darker, but we had very similar build and similar head shape.
I see. Well, he was a good friend of mine, and in fact, he gave me a souvenir that I still have. If you remember one of the years that he played here, late 90s, the Dragons had a Sunday uniform that they wore only on Sundays, and they he played. They had this uniform where there was a kind of a purple D on the breast, and it was sleeveless and hard to describe it. But anyway, they wore that on Sundays. And supposedly was supposed to be lucky, but I think they were something like 2-7.
I remember they were horrible.
Yeah.
Just like the uniforms.
And the manager, I think it was Hoshino, then decided, oh, let's get rid of these uniforms.
Burn,
and,
baby, burn.
Yeah, but one of them wasn't burned. It's at home in my closet. And it's got Leo Gomez autograph on it. So I really liked Leo. And Alex Ramirez, who's still playing, going into his 13th year. He's been a good friend, especially since I covered the Giants for NTV. We really got close when he played during his years with the Giants. And I guess for the short term, not necessarily a long-term player, but a guy who made an impact in a few years was Randy Bass and the Hanshin Tigers in 1985 when he won the Triple Crown.
Mm-hmm.
They won the Japan Series. He was MVP of the season, MVP of the series. He did it all, and I remember those guys particularly.
Okay. Well, Wayne is a walking encyclopedia of information on Japanese baseball, and it has truly been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, John. Good luck with the show, and I'd like to come on again sometime.
We'll have you, certainly. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
All right. Well, Wayne, thank you again very much, and thank you for being patient with the out there in the cold and wind.
Right. Yeah, I know your recorder has a hot air filter, but now it needs a cold air filter. Because the wind does tricks to it, man.
Yeah, it does. I tried to block the wind, but it just was swirling, coming from different directions. Anyway, how did you, what did you think about the talk?
Well, a lot of things surprised me. I mean, I remember the players who were in the game, and I do remember one of the players who was in the first game I saw, because my friend was a Chinichi Dragons fan, and he said, oh yeah, he's going to be a bright star for the future. You know, he was about a 32-year-old guy. They kept talking about what a promising player he was going to be.
Yikes.
So, in any case, yeah, that was that, and it was interesting to mention, hear the players he mentioned and some of the connections, and I saw Aaron Pointer, and I looked it up, and he was an NFL referee as well, so he's got quite a career.
I did not know that. Yeah,
and Bowles was played for the Giants in '62 when they went to the World Series. Little history there. It was interesting. I've never seen a game at Haywood Ice Stadium. And I have that kind of feeling. The first game I went to, if we can, shall I start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Was also on August 20th. I'm kidding, because I don't remember what day it was.
I was going to say, well, you're another Wayne.
No, I'm not in Wayne's world, man. Okay. Uh-huh. So first game was the Hanshin Tigers against the Chunichi Dragons at Toyama Prefectural Stadium in the Western League. Whoa.
Oh.
Because Toyama then, they had three midweek games every other year between the Giants and another team, usually the Yakult Swallows, and I was working and could never go to those, but they had Western League games now and then, and I didn't know the difference. So I went, and the interesting thing here is I got a foul ball on a hop. It came to me right on a hop, and I couldn't understand why all the kids wanted to come up and take it away from me. I'd been here a year and I'd never been to another game, and I'd been not even a year, but 11 months, and all the kids, it was 1985, and the kids kept, I had to like put it under my cap. I've probably thrown that ball away since then, but it was interesting. And the first big club game I went to was in 1987, again the Dragons against the Yakult Swallows, a day game at Jingu Stadium. Very rare in those days. I got home that evening, and I was living in Hamamatsu, and I found out it had been the first day game in two or three years at Jingu Stadium. And it was, I don't remember who was playing for the Swallows. I think Hideki Kuriyama was playing center field.
Wow.
I was sitting in right center field, and I saw a Dragons fan wander in, through the main aisle in the Swallows cheering section, and some guy punched him, and I was really shocked by that.
Wow, it gave you thoughts of home, like, the violence that used to go on a lot at Candlestick Park.
Yeah, if you wore a Dragons, if you wore a Dodgers cap at San Francisco after the Giants got really good, if you wore it into the outfield, you were just, taking your physical well-being in your own hands, because that was not a safe thing to do.
Tell me about it. I've been out there. Hit all my Dodger stuff, too.
The other memory of that is how different the Oendon was. That whole
cheering section. Mm-hmm.
And the famous leader of the Swallows cheering section, Mr. Okada. I remember at that time, because he stood up with one leg, one foot on the outfield wall, and was leading the cheers. And there were a couple of foreigners, I guess they were from the military, and they wandered up, and he had them lead the cheers for an inning.
Wow. Well, my first game was in Nagoya Stadium, the old Nagoya Stadium. It was in 1991. And I remember Mark Ryle was playing for the Dragons. And many of you might know his son Rusty, who played for the Arizona Diamondbacks and then briefly for the Giants. Anyway, the things that left an impression on me the most were, A, the fence around the infield. I had never seen anything like that. I tried to figure out why they wanted to stop the balls from going into the stands so people could get them. And as Wayne talked about in his interview, you couldn't keep them anyway, so it made sense. Then I thought, it goes hand in hand with the fence though, but the food was really, what really, really shocked me, because I couldn't believe they were serving hot noodles like ramen or soba noodles. in a bowl. And since you need two hands to eat something like that with the chopsticks and everything, there's no way you could catch a foul ball if it came at you. So, you know, after sitting there thinking about high-speed projectiles and hot soup and what could go wrong, it just hit me.
A ball hit you?
No, nothing hit me. The idea hit me. Oh, I see why they have the fence, because they serve these food items that require you to use two hands to eat. It's not like a hot dog. I mean, if you're in the States and you're holding a bag of peanuts, it's not so bad. And even if you lose the peanuts, it's not hot, scalding material. It's not going to... Nobody's going to get injured, so it's not really a problem if it's a hot dog. I mean, beer, I mean, you know, it could be bad, but it's not going to leave a mark, let's say. So the other thing was that when I went to the stadium, we sat in the general seating section, so we had to get there kind of early, and you literally had to run and save an area for your seat. And, right. And I'm like, well, don't we have tickets? Why do we have to run and save an area for the seats? And it was just so different for me. And one of the other things was how quiet the home team crowd was when the home team was in the field.
Yes.
You know, I couldn't believe they weren't screaming. You know, at least, you know, that looked like a strike, or, you know, come on, make, you know, hang in there, make a good pitch, or throw that curve again, something. But they just sat there quietly, you know, talking amongst themselves and waiting for their team to get the third out so that they can start screaming and singing the songs when they came to the when their team came up to bat. So those were the things that really, really struck me from my first game. And like I said, it was 1991. The Dragons lost that game, and I've had a long standing argument with Wayne that year the Dragons were in first place, and this is the 1991. The Hiroshima Carp won the title. And they came to town trailing the Dragons by a few games, I believe. Now, maybe, you know, the newspapers were wrong. The English papers were wrong, because I couldn't read Japanese at the time. So I was only looking at the English newspapers. But I thought they were back by a few games. And I know the Dragons got swept in the series, and Hiroshima left with the lead. This was in October. And they went on to win the Central League title. So Wayne says they were not up by three games. I said they were, but maybe I got bad information, because I trust Wayne. He's got the greatest memory of anybody I've ever met.
Don't try to bet him about the 1972-74 Orioles, because he knows the answer now.
I won't. But we really appreciate him coming on the show. And like I said, he is a living encyclopedia of baseball. He remembers these things right out on the tip of his tongue. He's got it right there.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So yeah, it was a real blessing to have him on the show, and look forward to hearing from him, you know, always in the near future. So
definitely. All right, moving right along, we're going to talk about Shohei Ohtani's about face. Now, I was talking to a scout the other day, and he said that, hey, listen, Kuriyama's getting a lot of the credit for this about face, and it's not all him. It's the general manager, Masao
Yamada,
really had a plan. They had a plan when they drafted him, and they wanted to execute it. And just like you go into a baseball game, you have your game plan in mind, and it's all about the execution. And they apparently executed it flawlessly and changed his thoughts. Now, what did you hear?
Well, what I understood was pretty much that the drag. Yeah, I can't say anything about Kuriyama's role, but that was the angle. You know how newspapers are. Once you get an angle, that's a story, and the truth doesn't really have to enter into it. But a couple of things are kind of interesting. I suspect the big deal was the same reason that Koji Uehara told me that he picked the Giants instead of the Los Angeles Angels then, or Anaheim Angels, or
something. I think they're Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim.
Anyway, he said essentially the difference wasn't the money, although the Angels all had $3 million, which is more than anything the Giants could offer him. The difference, according to Uehara, was that, one, he wasn't that certain about his English skills, and two, the Angels promised he would start no lower than double A. And the Giants said, double A, you can start on the first team, baby. And he said essentially that was the fact that being in Japan, playing at the top level, as opposed to being in double A with not being able to speak English very well, was kind of the deciding factor for him. So I think what happened with Ohtani, it was a case of, look, you know, you're going to get a chance to be on the first team, and we'll, you know, when a certain number of years under certain conditions, we'll post you. You can go to the majors then, and then everyone's going to be happy. And, you know, if we're lucky, we'll, you know, we'll make money off of you the way we made money off of Darvish.
Yeah, that was what my, I thought at the beginning was, hey, look, you can spend a year in rookie ball, let's say, another year in A if you move up.
Right, because he's young. I mean, he's a high school kid. He's not even Uehara.
He's going to have to start in rookie ball, and this is awful. And you're going to have these experiences that, I mean, you're going to have some life experiences. Maybe it'll be good. Maybe it'll be bad. Who knows?
Right.
We don't know. But if you stay here, you know what you're going to get.
But they'll take care of him. I mean, anybody who's, you know, they're going to all the trouble of signing him, he's not going to be like an American 19-year-old going to rookie ball where they put you essentially in a crack house.
Certainly, yeah. I don't know about crack house.
That's what Gabe Kapler called his A-ball apartment. They called it something, I forget what the street it was on, but we called it the A Street crack house. So,
nice.
So anyway, that's, you know, Masao Kita did that. He played in single A ball once in Florida, and he said it was a life changing experience.
Either that or life threatening.
Baller. Yeah. So I think from what I understood is once the fighters showed Dad pictures of these tales from the crypt of single A level baseball players' apartments, he went like, oh, I think I have my son's having second thoughts.
And if he's not, I'll beat some second thoughts into him.
No, he's a pretty big boy. I think he can handle Dad.
Well, my impression was that, yeah, I think obviously they said, hey, look, you know what you're going to get here in Japan. We're going to try to get you up to the first team as quickly as possible. You can sharpen your skills here. And like you said, whenever you want to be posted, just let us know and we'll try to work things out.
Yep. So I don't think he's actually signed a contract, but he has, he's basically got an offer for as much as the Dragons can, the fighters can give him, under the rules. They're actually more than guidelines now.
Oh. More than suggestions. Well, you know what? I'm really just happy for the fighters because they drafted Sugano last year and he turned them down, and they were staring at two consecutive years with drafting really quality, high quality pitchers or players or people who could help their club and coming away with nothing again.
And it wasn't, I think it was the day after they signed Ohtani that they went to NPB and said, look, we got to change the draft rules. This ain't working, which was, I think, the perfect timing. Because if you don't sign him, then it sounds like, well, we just want to keep, you know, we just, you know, we're tired of, you know, we're sick and tired of losing, like the Hawks were when they lost the second stage of the playoffs every year, and finally they got what they wanted, which was an advantage for the team winning the regular season because they got beat 3 years in a row.
Right. Well, yeah. Hopefully, they will change. I mean, you know how I feel about the draft. I'm not very partial to it, so hopefully they'll make some adjustments or some improvements or have a plan. But I think you what you're saying is so true about the fighters, and we talked about it in an earlier show about how they're so I think we talked about it when Matt Winters was on, but they have these plans, and I think that was part of their plan. We're going to draft this guy, and then we're going to take this idea or suggestion to NPB and we're going to try to make some changes.
Well, they've been trying to make changes. Toshi Shimada said, you know, basically every time they go to NPB, there is one team that in the other league which says, you want to do this means you just want to take something away from us. But it is, but we agreed which team it was. So, and I won't put words in his mouth. So I'll leave that to the listener's imagination.
Right. All right. Well, other things that we can leave that don't have to be left to the imagination are player acquisitions. We've had a lot of guys go from one team to another, or from the same team to another team, starting with Tony Blanco and Yelbert Soto going from the Chunichi Dragons to the Yokohama Bay Stars.
Really interesting. Really interesting. Historically interesting.
In that
Tony Blanco took over when Tyrone Woods left Japan. And Tyrone Woods, left, and this guy who was out of the majors for a while and was working his way back up, and they got Tony Blanco. And Tyrone Woods started his career in Japan with the Yokohama Bay Stars. And they didn't have enough money, and the Dragons were flush with cash, and so they got him. And they got Domingo Guzman, who the year before they got him was the Bay Stars' best pitcher. So it's like now the Bay Stars are going, hey, that Soto guy, you don't want him? We'll take him. That Blanco guy, you don't want him? We'll take him.
But it's puzzling for me that they would take another first baseman when they have a guy who was probably, and I didn't compare the numbers, but just as productive in Norihiro Nakamura already on the roster. I think the age is a little bit different, but, you know, Nori plays well. He plays better defense for sure, even if he had a broken leg.
Can't play him at third base anymore, Nori. So that is a question, and I don't know what they're planning on doing. Nori's they've got these 2,000 hit guys. You know, if they get Fukudome, if the Bay Stars get Fukudome, they're gonna have three guys who are looking at 2,000 hits. They're gonna be I think that's their plan. Is they're just gonna market this whole season and fire them all next year.
I think they're gonna fire them after the All-Star break.
But, Nakamura, I think, needs 11 or 12 hits. Alex Ramirez needs 8 hits. If Fukudome comes back with his hits in the States, he's real close to 2,000. So, it's really interesting. Anyway, Blanco was interesting because the second he signed, all the Dragons started lining up to say what a worthless player he was. And they're saying, look, he was never there when we needed him. He was always hurt. We would need a first baseman, and Blanco saying, oh, I'm sorry, I'm hurt. Well, Tony played when he was hurt a lot. I mean, he played with a broken thumb. He played with a broken this, a broken that. That's just sort of tired. And I think I don't think that's the individual Dragons talking as much as the organization telling him, you know, setting the tone for this discussion.
Yeah, well, the tone is that I think the tone now with the Bay Stars is that they have a bunch of first basemen.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what they do. Maybe they'll platoon them. I don't know. You can platoon at first base. So.
Well, Tsutsugo, you know, is the only one of those guys who bats left-handed, but he might play some third. But I think first base is his best position.
He's going to play third.
Yeah, he's going to have to. We talked about Alex Ramirez. I think he might be better suited for first base, but they'll probably have to put him in the outfield now.
Have to.
And, you know, all those situations that they've incurred with their, you know, poor defense and slow outfield is going to get worse.
Right. I don't see that improving. I know Arenami doesn't really have much of an arm in center, and they got no arm in left, and they're gonna pick a right fielder based on the person who can throw the ball to first base.
Yeah. But, you know, if you look at the other side, maybe they'll score a lot more runs. That could be a really formidable offense, and when they're playing at home.
They will score a lot more runs because they play in an excellent hitter's park. And, they'll score a ton of runs, but the problem is with your defense, it's hard to prevent a lot of runs from scoring. In that park, it's, you really gotta get outs now and then, or it's gonna be trouble. So, they're the tough slog.
Well, I still think Norihiro's gonna get his at bats, they're gonna have to decide, and he's probably the odd man out because he's one of the older guys, but I think he'll be well suited to pinch hit in late game situations, and he can fill in. He can still play defense at first base for sure. And I think he's going to be fine if he gets pushed to the side. I think he's going to be a help for them.
Here's the other thing is that also Tony hits he hits very well there. Another thing is this interleague comes up, and they've got, you know, it gives them 12 games. So they'll be set for interleague, which is good because they've been the worst interleague team in the history of the world. And I think that's all a plus. I do like Soto going there. I think Soto was a very good pitcher who the Dragons just never could find I don't know, they just couldn't figure out his mojo or something.
Well, he was injured. Yeah, he was injured a lot last year, and the first year I think he had some injury that he was coming off of at first, and they babied him, but he pitched really well.
And I understand Jorge Sosa is the next one to go, so
Yeah, I heard about that too. So yeah, everybody's coming this way, so I guess we'll see them when they get here.
And so we've had some other fairly interesting news. Akinori Iwamura going back home to the Yakult Swallows.
Yeah, now this is a stumper to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw him last year, and I'm, you know, he just, his swing looked slow and tired and sometimes broken. And other than that, I think he plays fine.
He's really been hurt since 2009 when he started having back troubles and knee troubles, and that really ran him out of the MLB, and it followed him to Rakuten. And last year he was healthy with one thing, and then something else went. So it's only, I think it's really, when he was healthy very briefly, and I saw him in a game when he was healthy, he looked pretty good. But, that was the only game I saw him. I talked to him a little bit. He said, yeah, he was feeling good. And 3 days later, he was on the farm team because he was hurt again.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, you know, maybe player coach kind of a thing, like Kazuyoshi Tatsunami was with the Dragons. Is that what they were thinking?
Could be. He'd be a good coach. He's very enthusiastic, and he's a very outgoing guy, and he's pretty blunt. He can be pretty blunt. So I hope so. I hope that's what they're thinking, and we'll see how that works.
Yeah, some of the other notable moves were
Dennis Sarfate, who was Sarfate, who was released by the Carp. He was signed by Cebu. And who also signed Brian Sikorsky and re-signed Randy Williams. So they've got three foreign relievers, although Sikorsky may not count as a Japanese now because he's been in Japan so long. So that I'm not certain I have to count that, but that could well be the case. I think he came in 2002.
And he'll be coming off of what, a year and a half of really not pitching? He didn't pitch at all last year, and he went out.
He had surgery, right?
Yeah, so.
He left after the earthquake. He didn't come back, and then he had surgery. Although I think those two things might be related. I don't know. So, yeah, that'll be good. I hope he's well. They're going to have, if it is, I know the talk was they want to move Wakui back to the starting rotation, which, considering how bad their starting rotation was, whether Wakui was in it or not last year, is probably a good idea, although he's going to have to be a lot better. He hasn't really been a good starter for close to 2 years.
Yeah.
Really since about May 2011. So that's a problem. What else have we got? We had Brian LaHare, who was very interesting, going to SoftBank. He's a minor league star, according to the Chicago Cubs general manager, Theo Epstein, and was going to be their first baseman. And he hit really well for average period in the first half of last year, and named to the NL All-Star team because, you know, you have to name somebody from the Chicago Cubs. You have to name somebody from every team.
Right.
And then his season promptly went in the tank, and he's in Japan. So he's a guy who certainly can play, but he made the wrong adjustments in Chicago, and that's why he's in Japan right now. So he'll get a whole bunch of new adjustments to make here, but if he makes the right ones, then he should be pretty good.
Okay, yeah, and I know that the Chunichi Dragons signed a hard-throwing right-handed pitcher named Daniel Cabrera.
A wild right hander.
And I remember him. I remember seeing him against, I think it was something like 2 years ago,
yeah,
against the Mariners, because they, you know, we get a lot of Mariners games over here when Ichiro was playing there. And yeah, the guy throws really hard. He just really didn't know where the ball was going. And it seems like that's not really cured, but maybe I don't know who's over there who could throw that hard and who can help him with his control.
2 years ago, he had Tommy John surgery 2 years ago. And, he had, before that, he had led the American League in walks twice, and he led the American League in wild pitches twice. That's the kind of pitcher he is. A really interesting case. So, he seems almost like the kind of guy the Hawks would bring up. You know, one of these guys who had a brilliant string in the, who looked like a big, you know, high flyer in the majors, who kind of fizzled and needs a restart, but the Dragons are going to be the ones. He's another Dominican. They were talking about Brandon Snyder, which kind of surprised me because all the Dragons players recently have been Dominicans. But Brandon Snyder since signed with the Texas Rangers, so that they're back to form.
Right.
And who else? We have Dickie Gonzalez, who is interesting because he's the second former Swallow and Giant to be released by Yomiuri in 2 years to go to Lotte.
Right, joining Seth Greisinger, who was on the show last year.
Seth started his career in Japan with the Swallows, went to Yomiuri after leading the league, Central League in wins, did well his first season with Yomiuri, first season and a half with Yomiuri. Then he fell out of their good graces, and Dickie was the guy who was in their good graces, and they figured, well, that foreign guy on the farm, that's like one too many, so let's just ignore him down there. And he was in the postseason, and he was ignored, and so they released him, and he's had trouble putting it together the last couple of years. He knows what he's doing. He's just, this is a question of when for him, whether he can give you a big year. He certainly has got quality stuff now and then. The last 2 years when he's pitched, he's had games where he was outstanding, but they've been pretty few and far between. So I hope he does very well with it would be nice to see him and Seth really win a lot of games for Lotte.
Yeah, it would really be nice. And I think Gonzalez, when he asked for a big paycheck after he had a really good season with the Giants, since that time, he hasn't been really effective. So I hope this change of scenery is what he needs to maybe refocus.
We had that marvelous season when, first of all, it seemed like he was ahead in every single count. It's like every first pitch was a strike that batters couldn't hit.
Yeah, he was much different from the way because he walked a lot of guys. He didn't pitch in the strike zone too much with the Swallows, and that got him into trouble sometimes. And
he also had arm trouble with the Swallows in 2000. He missed the entire 2006 season with the Swallows. So.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that change of scenery does well for him. Now, one of the big pickups that has drawn a lot of attention this offseason was the Rakuten Golden Eagles getting Andrew Jones.
Yeah.
And, again, I talked to a scout this past week, and he said, at 35, because, Jose Fernandez was about 38.
Yeah.
He should probably give him more than what Fernandez was giving him.
Okay.
But that's only if he's healthy.
Yep.
And nobody knows if he's healthy or not. And we'll just have to see. But this is a guy, I mean, wow, 434 career home runs in the States, Golden Gloves all over the place.
One of the people on my Twitter feed was asking, if he's one of the best players, best major league players to come to Japan. And yeah, I think he certainly have to go up in there.
The resume. Because last year, what was he, 197 with, 14 home runs in 94 games. He wasn't this great player.
No, he wasn't last year. The group he'd be in with would be Larry Doby, who's a Hall of Famer, I believe, and Reggie Smith, who was a borderline Hall of Famer, and
Bob Horner, didn't Horner come over here when he was somewhat still effective?
Bob Horner was a big famous home run hitter, but he wasn't really, I don't think in any way, shape or form, a really good player. He
had emphasis on big, huh?
Well, he was a big home run hitter in Atlanta. And he had power. I mean, there's no doubt he had power, but he was a pretty two-dimensional player. Lloyd Mosby, Jesse Barfield.
Jesse Barfield, okay.
Yeah, but really did nothing. Reggie Smith might have had the best career of those guys that came over.
Warren Cromartie.
Well, Warren Cromartie was not, Warren Cromartie was Andrew Jones light. He was the poor man. He was a great player, but, to say you're a kind of player like Andrew Jones, but you're not that good, is in no way an insult. It's like saying, well, he wasn't quite as good as Willie Mays. When Andrew Jones was 19 years old, he wasn't, he had a chance to be Willie Mays, which is very few players can say that. So, Andrew Jones was a great, great player in the major leagues. Those players so far have really yet to do anything in Japan. So it'll be interesting. I'd love to see him come here and I think he signed a 2-year contract. I'd love to see him, be an all-star and lead the team to a pennant. But if he does, it'll be a first.
Yeah, I would love to see those things too. I'm just not sure I'm going to. you know, as long as, first of all, if he's healthy, I think he's going to produce, but that has been his problem. And guys who are 35 don't get better at getting healthy.
That is so, so true. I did a study when I was writing my guides 16 years ago. And basically what one of the things I found is that one of the differences between young players and older players is that when young players get hurt, they come back. When old players get hurt, they don't come back, and they take longer to come back.
Mm.
That's a problem.
Yep, that's a problem. All right, so let's now talk about the WBC, and for that we're going to bring in our buddy Michael Westphal. What's happening, bud? Good to hear from you again.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, it's been we're doing well, I think. I think that's what Jim said. It's good to hear your voice again. Good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it's good to be on the show again. I always enjoy the show, listening at least.
Okay. Now, we're going to talk about the 34 players who were chosen recently. Now, this roster is tentative, and they're going to have – it has to be – well, how do we word this? 28 players can be active when the first game starts on March 2nd. Is that a good way to put it, Jim?
That's accurate.
Okay. But changes can be made. What did you say about the changes that can be made?
Well, first of all, I think it's February 28th is the cutoff day.
Okay.
And the changes can be made. There could be changes added to the teams, although the situation with the major leagues is that they want a long time advance notice before you take a player from their teams.
Don't go grabbing our guys without our knowledge.
I think it's 50 days before you add a guy to the roster. So we're basically they are about out of time to have anybody from the major leagues, which is okay because they don't really want anybody from the major leagues.
Right. Okay. Well, the thing, I mean, the 34 guys they have on there now, obviously six of them are going to get bounced. I think four of them are going to be pitchers, and that's what Michael's here to talk about. He's here to talk about one pitcher in particular. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, when Yamaguchi Shun re-signed with the Bay Stars a couple weeks ago, he had a bit of a problem with the Yokohama Bay Stars front office. He felt that he deserved a raise, and they felt that he deserved a pay cut. And
that is a problem.
Yeah. I know that I've complained to you, John, all season about, oh, no, Yamaguchi's in. He's going to blow it again.
Yes, you did. I would get email before he even walked anybody. He's going to walk this guy, and he's going to get a hit, and the bases are going to be loaded before you know, and blah, 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 and he's going to blow it. He's just going to blow it.
And that's how I just felt all season long. And it all started on March 30th, first game he participated in. He came in the 10th inning, up 5-4 against the Hanshin Tigers. And he gave up a one-out triple and a sacrifice fly, and he turned a victory into a tie, his very first outing. And that outing just stuck with me the whole season long. After his first seven games, he had a 7.36 ERA at April 21st.
Yeah, that can really make a fan and you like turn your eyes away from the TV.
I just wanted him gone. But
in favor of who? Who in that bullpen would you rather have brought in besides him?
Well, I really like Kaga. Kaga did struggle quite a bit this year. But I felt that he was really good in high-pressure situation in previous couple of years.
Okay.
So I don't know. I just have something against Yamaguchi.
Jim, what did you see in Yamaguchi this year?
Nothing I haven't seen before. He throws the ball pretty hard. He can keep the ball down when he tries to keep the ball down. He's erratic sometimes. I mean, some days he's untouchable. And other days he's just ordinary, and he throws the ball hard, and it's hard to get the bat on the ball.
Yeah, I just thought he had a lot of walks for a closer. 62 innings he threw this year, he had 22 walks, and I thought that was kind of high, and I expected guys to be waiting on pitches, but he struck out 62 guys too. So he struck out one per inning and walked one every three innings, about. So
yeah, somewhere around there.
Okay, continue, Michael. I'm sorry.
So from May 1st through July 4th, he actually went 20 games without allowing a single run.
So there you have it. You're taking a snapshot of the opening game, and you're letting it stain the memories you have of the whole season.
I think that's what it is. You know, I'm willing to say that one image really burned into me. And, yeah, I think that was basically it.
Yeah, he's still a young guy. He's still a fairly young guy.
Yeah, he's still got power. He can still throw the ball. I don't know. It's just so odd. Looking at the actual data and what I remember happening seemed to be two different people, two different images that are being left. So when he did the exact same thing, took a 3-2 lead on April 28th against the Giants, giving up the tying run on a pair of wild pitches, he did it again, just as he did his first appearance. And that image has really stuck in my mind. He only did it twice.
He only did it twice. And if you look at it, how many wins did Yokohama have? They had 46 wins. How many saves did he have?
Almost 22.
Almost half of their wins, he saved them.
Yeah.
And so when you think about it, when you put that into context, if let's say that they sometime in the near future win 80 games, and if he saves half of them, he's doing pretty good.
Yeah, I would have to agree there. So I guess that I really have not been giving Yamaguchi a fair trial.
Right.
That's kind of what I come away with from with this study.
John?
Yes, sir.
Does the name Imamura come to mind when we're talking about players whose impressions in that?
The Run Factory. Yeah, I he was awful. And last year he put it together. But before that, he was just a guy who came in and started forest fires.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I noticed the same thing Michael did. I didn't really notice how bad Yamaguchi was because, I was looking at the games I saw and, yeah, okay, Michael doesn't like Yamaguchi, but, you see him more than I do. I don't see him very often, and he looked okay when I saw him. And just when you mention it, from May 1st to the end of the season, he had 55 strikeouts in about 55 innings, walked 16 guys, allowed one home run. And, 0.99 ERA. So 20 saves in 53 games, a couple of holds, a win in relief, a loss in relief. Y'all pick.
Yeah, now
well, his one win, though, he came in with the game, with the Bay Stars winning and allowed a, home run to Abe on the first pitch to tie the game.
Yeah, so he's blown some saves for sure.
Actually, that's really the only – that and the two ties and his two losses were his five blown saves.
Okay, so that's not too bad.
So five blown saves I really don't think is worth the amount of whining I've done about him.
Whining is really never productive, and I'm probably the best example of that. So,
No, I think I am, but anyway. Well, of the relievers, I think he's going to stick with the team, and I'm looking at the pitching staff, and of the 34 guys they named, there are 16 pitchers. So I think, like I said, I think four pitchers get bounced. I think Daisuke Yamai, because that's kind of a baffler, puzzler why he was on there. I think he goes. I think Kenji Otonari, I think he's gone. Takuya Asao, I can't imagine why he's even on there from the start, but maybe,
well, for what he did 2 years ago.
Yeah, but he's not that guy anymore. And then, Kazuhisa Makita of the Lions.
I'm thinking
12 pitchers is enough. If you have to bounce somebody, I want the other guys. I was thinking that Nomi might be a guy you might not need.
I agree with that.
But I think when it gets down to you want the left-hander, I think they have enough right-handers. I think they want a left-hander, and I think Nomi will bank it.
Okay. Well, I like the team pretty much. I mean, Yamamoto's logic escapes me quite a lot, and I'll go back on my favorite subject, which is Junichi Tozawa, and I talked to an informed source who was party to the planning on this, and he blamed Tozawa. First of all, I asked the question, what about Tozawa? And it should have been about a 30-second answer. I got about a set of apologies and excuses for why Tozawa was not on the team. So that really blew me away.
How many minutes?
It was about 5 minutes.
5 minutes of apologies and excuses. Wow.
Why Kawasaki was such an important player, and why Tozawa was such an undesirable quality.
Right. Well.
Was that the decision was made in a very brief period of time by Yamamoto and Sadaharu Oh, according to this source, who is, I would say, very well placed.
Well, I really like this team. I don't think they're gonna. It might miss Tozawa, but I think pitching is a strong suit. I don't think, you know, with the guys they have, I don't think it's a problem. I think catcher could be a problem.
Because first of all, they're going to field, one thing is they're going to field the ball very well. And that's important. And Yamamoto is correct about the fact that it is, playing in international competition, fielding the ball, especially when you're playing in March, is so critical to these games because so many of these games are given away. And I don't think the Japanese team is going to will probably give away the fewest runs in the tournament. Just in making dumb plays.
Mm-hmm.
So that's such a big advantage for them. The hitters, they're going to be without Ichiro Suzuki mess stinking up the lineup for the first six games.
You can't say that.
Sure he can.
I agree, but you can't say it.
I didn't want Ichiro there last time.
He was good in the last two games. In fact, I don't even think he was good in the semifinals. I think he was only good in the final. He had one good game in a meaningless game against South Korea in the final game of the quarterfinal series in San Diego, and then he had the big game against South Korea. He did. He was good in the U.S. game. So that's three games he was pretty good, and one of them was meaningless. Yeah. So.
Well, now the catchers, that was one of the things that caught my eye because I thought Abe was going to just DH, and that Aikawa was a really good choice. But then Ginjiro Sumitani, on the strength of his home run and against Cuba, I guess, in those warm-up games, he's on the team. That's strange.
I don't understand it. I wouldn't put him on the team.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
But what are you going to do? I think I love having Inaba on the team because I think Inaba's he's the leader. He's the leader, and you really want him there. Some of the other logic for the major leaguers they picked. I'd love to have Aoki. I would love to have Aoki, but not going to get him. They're not going to have Darvish to fill in as their reliever when Fujikawa blows it, so they'll go somewhere else.
Yeah, but again, I think their pitching staff is fine. I think in fact, this team, and I don't think I said it, but I think this team is probably better than the team that sent last year. It's just younger and less experienced. But I think it's just as talented, if not more talented.
Well, yeah, they've certainly got something to prove this time, which is, I mean, last time they had something to prove, which was they could repeat, and this time what they've got to prove is, despite my disappointment over the selection process, which excluded a good player because of who he was, Tozawa, the value of having a motivational point of, oh, we're all made in Japan. We're going to show them what the players who are left in NPB can do has some value to it. It probably has more value than the added incremental value of having, Tozawa pitch four innings.
Right. Well, and then on the infield, the strange picks for me were Ibata. I think we talked about that before. And then Toritani. I know you like him. And they're both good. They're both good veterans. I don't think you need them both. I think one of them gets bounced.
That could well be. And if that's the case, it'll probably be Toritani.
Oh, I was going to say it was going to be Ibata, I thought.
No, I think it'll be Toritani because if Ibata's healthy, he's such a, I still love Ibata as a player because he's one of these guys who is so into the game. He's a lot like Inaba in that respect. He's got a great vision of the game. He has tremendous at bats now. And my drag against Toritani is he doesn't, you know, sometimes he just has lame at bats.
Yeah, but I don't think he's going to play. I think Sakamoto is going to play all the time. Michael, what do you think?
I have been concerned about Ibata's ability to be healthy more than anything else.
Yes, but see, a lot of teams throw pitches at him and they hit him and he gets injured.
Hasn't his lower back been a problem the past couple of years?
That's from trying to get out of the way of some of these inside pitches, I think. But anyway, no, it's probably they throw at him. They've been throwing at him for years, in my opinion, and he's gotten it down to a science where he jumps around or flops around like a fish out of water, and then he goes and gets some treatment for about 5 minutes in the training room, and he comes out like nothing ever happened. he does all the time. Go ahead, Jim.
I'd love to have him on the team. They're going to have a tremendous outfield. Uchikawa was kind of an interesting pick, you know, more on reputation than on anything else. But he, I'll tell you, in the 2009, he was a player who could have been the MVP of the Japan team.
Definitely.
And 2006, I don't remember, he wasn't on the team in 2006, but he had just made so many amazing catches in the, his defense was worth the price of admission. So, I'm really excited about the team. He's a gamer. He hasn't done anything in the last year. The answer is no. Of course, he was hurt, and he was always hurt the last year and a half mostly. But I like the team. I love Matsuda. I love Honda.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Honda. In fact, I like the outfield too, but I think they have 7 outfielders. I don't think they need that many. They have 3 right-handed batters, 3 left-handed batters, and a switch hitter. And I just think somebody's going to get left off. And you mentioned Uchikawa. I'm not sure if it's going to be him or, geez, I have no idea. I was thinking Kakunaka. He's coming off of, he's the one defensive liability. And I thought it might be him, but I really can't decide. But I think that's going to be the other guy. I think it's going to be 1 infielder and 1 outfielder and 4 pitchers.
This is Japan. They'll probably decide the roster for the WBC based on the final batting practice.
And they'll decide who's going to be closer based on Michael Westbay's research. All right. Well, Michael, thank you for joining us for this segment of the show.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
And thank you for doing that little check on Mr. Yamaguchi. And let's see if you can find some other details about, or some interesting details about some of the other closers during the offseason. And we'll have you back on before the season starts next year.
I look forward to it.
All right, buddy. Take it easy. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Yamaguchi is really interesting, especially his contract issues, because he was coming out screaming and hollering, saying the Bay Stars want to cut my salary, and the Bay Star says, no, we weren't trying to cut your salary. And I'm just really curious about how that misunderstanding could come about, because when he signed, the report was he signed for the same offer that was not good enough for him and was good enough for the team and was, in fact, not a pay cut, according to somebody. So there's a lot of weird information out there. But that's the norm for most of these salary negotiations. I've been watching this year, and the last thing I'll say about it is I've seen almost every player who's turned down his first request comes back 2 or 3 days later. They cool off, and they say, oh, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah, try working for a living, guys. That's all I have to say about that.
Okay.
I mean, you know, most of the time the teams get it right, in my opinion. Some guys have been really knocked off their rockers with these pay cuts, but most of the time they get it right. Sometimes they overpay for some guys, but in Japan they obviously pay you for what you did the previous season, not what they think you're going to do the next season, or in part what they think you're going to do the next season, but mostly what you did the previous season. So,
right,
go out and earn some more money. I mean,
the guys who make the really big paychecks are the guys who have 2 or 3 years in a row where they're really good.
Right.
And they get these astronomical figures, and then no matter how bad they are, they can't cut them with the, you know, unless, you know, you're Michihiro Ogasawara or something.
Yes. Who suffered a very huge pay cut, right?
They signed him to a 2-year deal in which he was absolutely worthless. they signed him to the biggest contract in Japan, and he was absolutely worthless for 2 years. So it's not quite, he's taking the biggest pay cut in Japanese baseball history, but yeah, well, he was the worst player in Japanese baseball for 2 years. So yeah, that kind of goes with the territory, but.
Hey, you holding a hammer or something? Can you put that thing down for a little while?
And I'm glad, you know, he's a good guy, and I'm glad that he's coming back and he put a good face on it. And he got the contract he deserved, and then his body just gave up on him for 2 years. So it's nothing personal, but the timing was terrible for the Giants, and that they gave him a contract which he earned, and then nothing went right. So so that's that.
All right, well, we're running long here, so let's go to fielding questions. All right, the first one is from Matt Vernon of Kansas City, Missouri, and you might remember Matt. He wrote in for our last show, and he said, "What are you hearing about the changes to the posting system?" And I read an article that Japan was concerned about the posting fees being very high, and that U.S. teams would start offering less and less to get rights to Japanese players. So I put in a call to one of my reporter buddies, and he said, no, that's not really what the case was. The real reason was the U.S. teams have been paying extra money, essentially, to overbid,
right,
to ensure that they outbid the other guy. So
right,
whatever their high line is, they add a few – another plus X million bucks on top of that just to ensure that their bid is higher. And that might get taken away, or that would get taken away, if they made these changes to the posting system. And the change that they're talking about is making it an open auction, not a sealed auction where the bids are made public. And I guess you can make a counter offer. Have they talked about how they're actually going to do it? I haven't seen any articles about that.
If you're going to have an open bid, then you have to have then it's not an open bid if everybody presents their sealed bids and opens them at the same time.
Right.
Open bid if teams bid against each other in an open auction, which is, I think, what they want. That's okay. Now the time frame on this is very interesting, because day one, the story is out of NPB. We are negotiating with the majors about changes in the posting season system. We want to see changes. Now, one of the changes Japan would not like to see is less money for the Japanese teams.
So
I doubt that that was their idea. And in fact, the idea is, but then the next day is the majors want the open bidding system. So, what do I think? Japan wants to see a system where not just one team gets to bid on the player, or gets the rights to bid on the player. And what might happen is this: you have an open bid, the high bidder gets 30 days to sign a contract. If he doesn't sign a contract, the next bidder has an option. You can pay the same price as the previous team.
Mm-hmm.
And you get 30 days to sign them.
Hmm.
You know, so the next team, the team that offered the, you know, made the next highest bid.
So essentially, yeah, your posting fee plus whatever salary you're willing to pay, if that number is larger than the other team, you know, and you have first dibs, then you're going to get him. If your
salary's got nothing to do with it. We're only talking about the team, the money going to the Japanese team. And then, but they'll have to sign a contract with the player. And if they don't sign a contract with the player, then the next most interested team would have some kind of an option. You know, do you want to pony up the extra money and have negotiating rights, or you want to pass on the whole thing?
Oh, okay. In my mind, my position was that a team would figure out that total figure, the posting fee plus whatever salary they think they want to pay this player. And that's their figure that they go to the table with, and they start subtracting. Let's say if the posting fee goes higher than they expected, they would maybe say, hey, if they win the negotiating rights, they say, this is all we can offer you. How's that? You know what I'm saying? They have a total price in mind for the entire transaction or acquisition.
Well, any team, that's what teams do already.
Right. So that's what I was saying.
That's no different from the way it is now, except that that the money, you know, the balance of the money would go to the player, which is what the MLB wants and probably not what NPB wants. Yeah, I doubt if that's the case. That's in essence no different from the way it is now, because the team's budget for this is how much we're willing to pay, and mm-hmm. And some of it will be negotiated out of them. You know, in the case of Matsuzaka, I don't think they intended to pay Matsuzaka, you know, $50 million, $60 million for 6 years. But in the case of Iwakuma, I think that's exactly what happened. The A's had a budget for exactly how much they thought Iwakuma was worth, and when his contract demands were significantly higher than that, they said, well, no, he's just not worth it, so we're not going to get into that market. It doesn't make sense, which is what they do.
Right. So, yeah, I think, you know, and I thought about this for a second when I heard about the fact that, yeah, the U.S. side wants is the actual initiator of this idea of the change to the posting system. But
I don't agree with that. I haven't heard that it was the U.S. side that was initiating it. I heard Japan wanted changes and the U.S. wanted changes.
Okay, well, I was told it was the U.S. side that wanted the changes, but the Japan side is willing to make the changes.
Willing to make changes instead of the changes.
Okay, make changes. So anyway, in the end, I thought, though, if you're, let's say the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Angels and the Dodgers, let's say the big spenders right now, are getting into a bidding war with somebody, aren't they actually going to end up paying that high astronomical figure in the end? Because if you really want the player,
yep,
you're going to drive the price up.
Exactly.
So what's the difference whether you know what the actual figure is or you don't know what the actual figure is? It's all about what you're willing to pay.
Exactly. But here's the thing. What happens is it keeps teams from overbidding on when there isn't much of a market for them.
Okay.
Okay, so
For the player?
Player, right. You know, let's say there's a player they want and they're the only team that wants him. You know, they're not, if they think, oh, this guy's going to fly over here and nobody else shares that opinion, then they get a bargain. Right. And that happens the time. Teams have difference of opinions all the time. Obviously, teams have differences of opinions, or you never would have seen a trade like last week where with the Devil Rays and Royals. So Rays and Royals. So.
Well, I thought that maybe one possible residual effect, if they do have this open auction, might be the Japanese team's reluctance to post players, possibly, because they might feel they might not get the kind of offer that they feel warrants them giving up on a player who's obviously had some success for them. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Often now, the motive for posting a player is a personal agreement with the player.
Yeah.
So we saw that with Darvish, and we saw that with Nishioka. The Marines were saying, look, you know, we don't care if, you know, the bid is 10 cents. We'll let you go.
See you, kid. Watch out for that door.
Where's the dime? Okay.
All right. Next question is from Dave McNeely. He says, you guys were talking about the Hall of Fame vote the other day, and it made me wonder, has anyone ever gotten into the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame on the first ballot? I mean, it looks like Shigeo Nagashima, 9 years on the ballot. Masaichi Kaneda, 13 years. Katsuya Nomura, 3 or 4 years. Isao Harimoto, 5 years, and 9 years for Sadaharu Oh. If these guys aren't first ballot Hall of Famers, who the hell would be? We can say hell on the show. And what could possibly be the excuse for making these guys wait so long?
Well, the excuse is this, is that the rules change. The eligibility rules changed. And it used when I first got here, the rule was you had to have been out of uniform for a certain number of years.
Mm-hmm.
So if you quit playing and then you became a coach like Sadahara Oh did, he was kind of like the vice manager or the sub manager of the Giants, and then you become a manager, you're not eligible until after you stop managing for a period I believe at that time it was longer than 5 years. And the reason I'm going to guess that is that for one reason is Shigeo Nagashima. Now he managed until 1980, and 1989 the Yakult Swallows. He was eligible to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, and he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. And the Yakult Swallows came in looking for him to be their manager. And I believe the reason they were trying to get him to be their manager is he was elected in the first opportunity he had to be into the Hall of Fame. He'd sat out X number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he turned him down, reportedly, because they announced to the media that he was going to be their manager, and they didn't have a firm agreement. And mm-hmm. The reason they wanted him to be their manager was so that they could draft Kazushige Nagashima.
Oh, it's the trades and the moves you don't make that are so successful sometimes.
Yeah, which worked out wonders for the Bay Stars because they got Koki Morita when they lost the lottery. And Morita was a pretty good player. So anyway, so I think that's what happened. And I believe Nomura, I believe, was made to wait a year because he finished playing in 1980, the same year that Nagashima stopped managing. Nagashima stopped managing because he was fired by the Giants. And
that'd make you stop.
And they made Nomura wait a year, which doesn't surprise me. Nagashima was fabulously popular, and Nomura was always controversial, so they made him wait a year. Sadaharu Oh, of course, was 5 years after he stopped managing, which leads me to believe that sometime between 1989 and 1993, they changed the waiting period from 8 years to 5 years.
Well, I got the question, I got it earlier in the week or in the middle of the week, and I didn't have time to call the Hall of Fame Museum and speak to, or the library, and speak to my buddy whom I spoke last year. If you might remember, I was calling to inquire about the number of foreign passport holders who are in the hall.
Yep, good luck.
Anyone? Yeah, so I made the call. So I wasn't able to call and ask them, anything about the rules and anything on this topic, but I did talk to one of the reporters downstairs in the at the Omiri, and he said, look, as far as he knew, there were only two players, Sadaharu Oh and Victor Starfin, who were ever voted in the first time, first ballot Hall of Famers, voted in on their first opportunity or their first year of eligibility. So the only thing that I could say to that is it's just like everything else in Japan. You have to earn your way. You have to pay your dues. You have to,
In Starman's case, he had to die his way into the Hall of Fame.
Gosh. That I did not know, but, yeah, I mean, nothing comes easy. I mean, you know, they make you wait. You have to work your way up. It's just like the sumo world. You have to work your way up by doing all the dirty work. And I guess the dirty work in this case is, you know, making you wait. Some of it might be favoritism, some of it might be bias. All the people who vote, some of the former players, and they sit around saying, well, I could beat that guy with one arm tied behind my back, and they don't vote for him until they see him pop up, you know, three or four times, maybe five or six times on the ballot. I don't know how it...
Well, certainly the big change is now that players can be elected to the Hall of Fame while they're managing and while they're coaching. They can... Mm-hmm. Now the rule is you have to not be playing. So that is definitely different from the way it used to be. So, and if he said Oh was, in on the first ballot, which I certainly agree with, then that was the 5 years because he was out of the Giants uniform for 5 years. And then as soon as he was in the Hall of Fame, then Bob Berry goes to the Fukuoka Soft, Daiei Hawks. So.
Right. All right, so I hope that answers the question. Perhaps in the future I can call the Hall of Fame Museum and Library and speak to my buddy and get some more details on it. But anyone else who has a question, please send them, or questions or comments, send them via MP3 or let me do that again. Anyone else who has questions or comments, you can send an MP3 to us at yakyujohn, yakyujohn @gmail.com, or you can leave us a comment on the Facebook page. And we'll play it on the show or talk about it on the show, just like we did with Dave's comment and Matt's comment. Thank you guys very much for sending them in.
Yep, thank you. Look forward to hearing from you all in the new year.
Yeah, well, happy holidays to everyone. I want to say Merry Christmas, but I don't want to offend anybody, but I guess I just said Merry Christmas.
You did, and you offended me.
That happens all the time.
That is true. It does happen all the time, but we're buds, so, you know, it just goes, you know, it's part of the process. So anyway, no, enjoy your holiday season, and I wish you all the best of health and the happiest of New Year's.
Yes, Happy New Year to all. Thank you very much for listening this year, and we hope to have great shows for you next year as well.
Okay, see you guys.
All right, enjoy the holidays.